Welcome back to another deep dive. Remember those fascinating journeys we took through different wine regions and the microscopic world of yeast?
Absolutely.
Well, get ready, because today we're going even deeper. We're taking you on a step-by-step tour through the whole winemaking process.
That's right, from the moment those grapes leave the vine to that satisfying pop of the cork.
And guiding us through this intricate process is an expert who can really, like, connect all the dots and can show us what's behind that bottle of wine you enjoy.
It's a fascinating blend of art and science and a lot of passion. We'll uncover the choices that winemakers make, both big and small, that shape the flavors in each sip.
I'm already picturing the vineyards and the anticipation of harvest. But before we jump ahead, let's go back to the beginning. When we talk about wine grapes, are we talking about just one type, or are there many varieties?
Imagine a family tree with over 1,300 branches. That's how diverse the world of wine grapes really is.
1,300.
Yeah.
Wow. So each variety has its own unique flavor, right? Like, if I taste a Cabernet Sauvignon, will it always taste the same wherever it's grown?
That's where terroir comes in. The grape is only one part of the puzzle. The place where it's grown, the soil, the climate, even how high up it is, those all impact the final product. And then you have the winemakers touch the techniques they use.
Oh, so it's like a mix of nature and human skill.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us some examples? What are some types of grapes our listeners might not know about?
Sure. Most wine enthusiasts know Cabernet Sauvignon or Chardonnay. But have you ever heard of Krisegi Fusaris?
Krisegi Fusaris. That's a new one for me.
It's from Hungary. It has a great acidity and a spicy note that you might find similar to Gewürztraminer.
Krisegi Fusaris. I'm adding that to my list to try. Now, thinking about all these varieties, where did grapevines even come from? Were they always used for wine?
You might be surprised to know that wine grapes actually started here in North America. All the Vitis species, which includes wine grapes, originated here.
Really? North America? I didn't know that.
Over time, people started selecting and growing certain types of Vitis vinifera to use for wine. They were looking for things like bigger berries and vines that could pollinate themselves.
Interesting. So how did these North American vines end up being the main ones in vineyards worldwide?
Well, if you think about classic varieties like Traminer, Pinot Noir, or Weissling, they all actually came from a wild ancestor called Vitis vinifera subspecies sylvestris. And with DNA fingerprinting, we can see these family trees even more clearly now and even debunk some myths about their origins.
It's like a family history project for grapes. Are there any examples where DNA analysis has changed what we thought about a grape's history?
Absolutely. Take Müller-Thurgau, for instance. There were so many theories about its parentage, but with DNA, we finally figured out its real origins.
So DNA is helping us solve great mysteries. What about those grapes that aren't as famous, you know, the more ordinary ones? Did those ever play a role in creating those really well-known varieties?
You'd be surprised. Heunisch Weiss, which is also known as Gouais Blanc, is a perfect example of how everything is connected in the world of grapes. It wasn't considered a very high-quality grape, but DNA showed us that it's apparent to many famous varieties.
Like which ones?
Like Chardonnay and Gamay Noir, for example.
Gouais Blanc, the hidden gem of the vineyard. It proves that every grape has a story.
So now that we've explored where those vines come from, let's move to the vineyard itself. Say you've planted a new vine. What's the process like from a small cutting to a flourishing vine full of grapes?
Well, it all begins with propagation. We often use cane cuttings, which are sections of mature cane, and plant those.
So like choosing the best seedlings for your garden.
Exactly. We select them carefully and plant them so they can grow into new vines.
So it's about setting those baby vines up for success. What are some of the key things to think about when choosing those cuttings?
Things like the size, bud health, and how mature it is. You want cuttings that are the right length, have healthy buds, and show signs of good lignification.
Yeah, you know that woody maturity that tells you they're ready to root and grow.
Gotcha. So it's all about picking the strongest contenders for the vineyard. Okay, the cuttings are in the ground, they're starting to root. What happens next?
Well, then sunlight becomes really important. Grapevines love the sun. They need it to photosynthesize and produce those sugary grapes. That's where pruning and training systems come in.
Ah, so that's why vineyards have those neat rows of vines. It's all about getting as much sun as possible.
Exactly. Pruning helps us remove extra leaves and shape the vine. And training systems, like trellises, help guide the growth and position the grapes for optimal sunlight and air circulation.
So you're basically giving each vine its own custom-tailored suit.
That's a great way to think about it.
And I'm guessing there are different styles of training systems, right?
Mm.
Depending on the climate or the kind of grapes you're growing.
You got it. There are high training systems where the canopy is higher up and low training systems closer to the ground. The choice depends on a lot of factors: the climate, the grape variety, even the style of wine you want to make. For instance, higher systems are good in cooler places because they can help protect the grapes from frost.
It's like a vineyard fashion show. Each vine gets to shine in its best outfit. Now let's talk about the roots, the foundation of the vine. What role do rootstocks play in how well a vine grows and produces grapes?
Rootstocks are incredibly important. They're what anchor the vine, absorb water and nutrients, and can influence things like how strong the vine grows, how resistant it is to diseases, and even when those grapes ripen. It's like the foundation of a house. It has to be strong and stable.
So it's another big decision grape growers make behind the scenes that really impacts the vine's life. Are there any specific examples where choosing a particular rootstock can drastically change the grapes?
Oh, absolutely. Think about phylloxera, that tiny insect that almost destroyed European vineyards in the 19th century. The solution was to graft European Vitis vinifera vines onto rootstocks from American vines that were resistant to it.
Wow, American rootstocks saved European wine. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So rootstocks are a big deal. Now we've covered sunlight and roots. What about things like weather? What kind of challenges do grape growers face from the environment?
Well, grapevines are very sensitive to how much water they get.
I can imagine.
Finding that perfect balance, not too dry, not too wet, that's a constant challenge. Droughts and too much rain can really impact both the amount and the quality of those grapes.
So it's a delicate dance. How do grape growers find that balance? Is it all about hoping for the best?
Not quite. Irrigation is key, but it's not just about giving them water, it's about giving them the right amount at the right time. There's a technique called regulated deficit irrigation, or RDI, which involves intentionally reducing water at certain points during the grape's growth.
So you're not constantly watering those vines. There's actually a strategy to sometimes holding back water.
Exactly. A little bit of controlled water stress can actually make the flavors and aromas in the grapes even stronger. It's like pushing those vines to work a little harder, which gives you more complex grapes.
I think a boot camp for grapes.
Now, besides water, what other nutrients do vines need? Is there a specific grapevine diet?
Just like us, vines need a balanced diet. They need minerals like nitrogen, potassium, and magnesium to grow healthy and produce high-quality grapes.
So it's more than just sun and water. There's a whole underground world of nutrition going on. How do growers make sure their vines are getting what they need?
There are two main ways: organic and inorganic fertilizers. Organic fertilizers like compost and manure are all natural and they release nutrients slowly.
That sounds very eco-friendly. Are there any downsides to using organic fertilizers, though?
The main challenge is that you can't always predict how quickly the nutrients will be released. It depends on things like the weather, the soil, and what the compost is made of. So there's an element of chance involved. What about inorganic fertilizers? Are they more predictable?
Inorganic fertilizers are more like a precise supplement. Growers can control exactly how much of each nutrient they're giving the vines and when.
I see. So it's very tailored. But I guess there are environmental concerns with inorganic fertilizers, right?
Yes, that's definitely something to consider. If they're not managed carefully, they can lead to runoff, which can affect water quality and nearby ecosystems.
So, like anything else, there are pros and cons. It seems like finding the right balance between keeping the vines healthy, producing good grapes, and protecting the environment is key.
You've got it. And that brings us to that exciting moment we've all been waiting for, when the grapes are finally ripe. All those months of work in the vineyard lead up to this stage, where those grapes go from tart and green to plump and full of flavor.
It's like the main event. How do grape growers know when the grapes are perfectly ripe? Do they just taste them?
Tasting is part of it, but there's more to it than that. Growers look at sugar levels, acidity, and phenolic maturity.
Phenolic maturity. What's that?
It's about how developed those compounds are that give wine its color, aroma, and texture.
So it's not just about sweetness. There's a whole lot going on inside those grapes. What influences when it's time to harvest? Is it just a date on the calendar, or are there other things to think about?
Climate plays a big role. A warmer growing season usually means the grapes ripen earlier than a cooler one, and the type of grape matters too. Some grapes naturally ripen earlier than others.
So each grape has its own rhythm, but I'd imagine the winemaker also gets to decide when those grapes are picked, right?
Absolutely. The winemaker's vision for the wine is really important. Some might pick grapes a little earlier to keep more acidity and freshness, while others might wait for those higher sugar levels to get a richer style.
So it's another one of those choices that shape the wine's personality. Okay, the grapes are perfectly ripe. It's time to harvest. What does that look like? Is it like in the movies with people hand-picking grapes in Tuscany?
Harvesting can be done by hand or with machines. Manual harvesting, where people carefully pick each bunch, is still common, especially for high-end wines or in vineyards with tough terrain.
Yeah, I can picture those beautiful scenes, people working together, connected to the land. What about larger vineyards where hand-picking isn't practical?
That's where mechanical harvesting comes in. There are machines that shake or vibrate the vines so the ripe grapes fall off into bins. It's way faster and more efficient, especially for those big operations.
Efficiency is key. But I imagine there are trade-offs, right? What are the downsides to using machines instead of people?
One concern is that you might lose some juice or damage the grapes during mechanical harvesting. And some winemakers feel that handpicking gives you higher quality grapes because you can be really selective.
So again, there's no one right answer. It depends on the situation and what the winemaker wants.
Okay.
So the grapes are picked, they're at the winery. What's next? Do they go straight into those big fermentation tanks?
Well, first, there's grape processing. The first decision is whether to crush and destem the grapes. This separates the berries from the stems and gently breaks them open to release the juice.
So it's the moment the grapes give up their liquid gold.
Mm-hmm.
Are there different ways to crush and destem grapes?
Absolutely. It depends on the kind of wine you're making. Sometimes leaving some of the stems in can add complexity and tannins, which can make a bolder, age-worthy wine.
Wow, even the stems contribute to the final product. And once the grapes are crushed and destemmed, are they ready to become wine?
Almost. For some grapes, especially those with thick skins or that hold on to their juice tightly, we might add an enzyme treatment.
Enzymes? Like the ones we take for digestion. What do they do for wine?
We're talking about different kinds of enzymes, but the idea is similar. We might add pectinase, a natural enzyme, to help break down pectin in the grapes.
Pectin?
It's a substance in grape cell walls. This helps to release more juice when we press the grapes.
So it's like giving the grapes a little help to share all their delicious juice.
Okay, we've talked a lot about everything from where grapevines come from and what goes on in the vineyard to harvesting and getting those grapes ready for the next stage. I'm already feeling like I know so much more about wine, but I know the real magic is still to come. What happens next? How do those grapes actually become wine?
That's where fermentation comes in. It's the process that turns that sugary grape juice into the alcoholic beverage we know as wine. Remember those microscopic yeasts we talked about earlier? They're the stars of this show.
Ah, yes, our tiny friends, the yeasts. We had a whole deep dive on those guys. But tell me, what kind of decisions do winemakers make when it comes to yeast and fermentation?
Well, one of the first things is deciding whether to use those naturally present yeasts, you know, the ones that are already on the grapes and in the winery, or if we're going to add a specific cultured yeast.
So indigenous versus commercial yeast, right? We touched on that in our yeast episode.
Exactly. Those indigenous yeasts can really give a wine a unique sense of place, you know, expressing the terroir of the vineyard.
So they're like the local artists of the wine world, reflecting where they come from.
That's a great way to put it. But there are times when a winemaker wants more control over the fermentation. So they might choose a specific yeast that's known to bring out certain aromas or flavors, or one that does well in specific conditions.
So it's like choosing the right yeast for the job. What kind of factors influence that decision?
Well, it depends on what the winemaker is aiming for. If they want to make a delicate white wine, they might choose a yeast that produces fruity esters and keeps that acidity. But for a bigger red, maybe they want a yeast that can handle higher alcohol levels and pull out more tannins from those grape skins.
So it's like choosing the right tool for the job. Once those yeasts are in place and ready to go, what happens next?
That's when the real fun begins. The yeasts start eating the sugar in the juice. And that turns it into alcohol, carbon dioxide, and heat.
So those bubbles we see in a fermenting tank are the yeast, like breathing out?
Exactly. It's their way of saying, hey, we're busy making delicious wine over here.
Yeah.
But fermentation is a lot more than just bubbles. It's a very controlled process.
What are some of the things winemakers have to pay close attention to during fermentation?
Temperature is key. Yeast is a bit fussy, too hot, and it gets stressed, too cold, and it slows down. We have to keep an eye on those temperatures and adjust them to make sure the yeasts are happy and doing their thing.
So it's all about finding that Goldilocks zone for the yeast,
yeah.
Right? Not too hot, not too cold, but just right. What about oxygen? Does that play a role in fermentation?
Oxygen is an interesting one. In the beginning, a little bit of oxygen helps those yeasts get going. But once things are underway, Too much oxygen can lead to oxidation.
And that's a bad thing.
It can dull those beautiful fruity flavors in the wine and sometimes even create aromas we don't want.
So it's a delicate balance.
Okay.
Just enough oxygen to get things started, but not too much to mess things up. It's incredible how much care goes into every step.
It really is. And what we've talked about is just the beginning. After fermentation, there were more steps. Malolactic fermentation, clarifying the wine, stabilizing it, and aging.
Malolactic fermentation. That sounds interesting. What's that all about?
It's a second fermentation where malic acid, which is naturally in grapes and have that tart, apple-y taste, gets converted into lactic acid.
And what's the difference?
Lactic acid is softer and creamier.
Ah, so it's like smoothing out the wine a little bit. Do all wines go through malolactic fermentation?
It's more common for reds and some whites, like Chardonnay. It can add complexity, roundness, and those buttery notes people often enjoy in Chardonnay.
Okay, so malolactic fermentation for some wines. What about clarifying and stabilizing? What happens there?
Clarification is about getting rid of any particles that could make the wine cloudy. We can do this by fining, which means adding something like egg whites or bentonite clay to the wine.
What do those do?
They bind to the particles and help them settle out, so you're left with a clear wine.
It's like giving the wine a facial.
Huh. That's a good way to think about it. Then there's stabilization, which helps keep the wine clear and stable for longer. One common way to do this is cold stabilization, where you chill the wine so those tartaric acid crystals fall out.
So those little crystals you sometimes see in wine, that's tartaric acid.
That's right. Cold stabilization prevents those from forming in the bottle. And then, of course, there's aging.
Yes, aging. That's when all those complex aromas and flavors really come together, right?
Exactly. Aging lets the wine mature and develop those special qualities that make each bottle unique.
This has been such a journey. We've gone from those tiny grape seeds to the moment that finished bottled wine is ready to be enjoyed.
It's amazing, isn't it? It really shows the hard work and passion that goes into making wine.
I definitely have a newfound appreciation for what it takes to make a bottle of wine. Thank you so much for guiding us through this deep dive into winemaking.
It really is a testament to the dedication of everyone involved.
I'm definitely looking at my next glass of wine differently now. But we've talked about aging. What are we talking about here? Stainless steel tanks, oak barrels, maybe a mix of both.
You got it. There are lots of options, and the choice really depends on the style of wine.
So stainless steel versus oak, what's the difference?
Stainless steel tanks are neutral, so they let those pure fruit flavors shine through. You know, they keep the wine fresh and vibrant. Oak, on the other hand, adds its own unique character to the wine.
I've definitely noticed that oaky flavor in some wines. What kind of flavors does oak add?
Well, it depends on the type of oak and how the barrels are made, but you often get those warm, spicy notes, vanilla, sometimes even a hint of toast or coffee.
So it's like adding another layer of complexity to the wine.
Exactly. And oak can also soften those tannins, those astringent compounds that you can sometimes feel in red wines.
So it's not just about flavor, it's about texture too.
Exactly. It's about creating a well-rounded, balanced wine.
Okay, so the wine is aged, it's developed those beautiful flavors and aromas.
Mm-hmm.
What's next? Is it finally time to pop those corks?
Almost. There are a few more steps before those bottles hit the shelves. We need to make sure the wine is crystal clear and that it's going to stay that way.
Right. We talked about clarifying the wine earlier. What about those crystals that can sometimes form in wine?
Ah, yes. The tartaric acid crystals. Remember, cold stabilization. That helps prevent those from forming in the bottle.
Right. It's like giving the wine its winter coat.
Exactly. And then finally, we bottle the wine, label it, and send it out into the world.
And that's when we get to enjoy it. It's incredible to think about everything that goes into each bottle, from those tiny grape seeds to the moment we finally get to savor those complex flavors.
It's a true labor of love.
It really is. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us and taking us on this amazing journey through the world of winemaking.
It was my pleasure. Cheers to great wine and the incredible process that brings it to our tables.
Cheers to that. And to our listeners, we'll see you on our next deep dive. Until then, keep exploring, stay curious, and as always, enjoy those delicious discoveries.